Welcome to the USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast. USCHoops.com College Basketball Podcast is the original podcast covering USC Trojans men's college basketball team and is available on such platforms as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn, as well as at the USCHoops.com website. If you haven't done so already, we'd really appreciate it if you gave us a five-star rating and left a review on the platform of your choice. And a very happy Saturday to everybody, June 8th, 2024. We're back with Chase and Nick and Jason. Nick, Jason, how are you guys doing?
Doing awesome, Chase.
Doing well, Chase.
Okay, so I know the last podcast we did, we basically talked about, hey, the roster is complete now, and let's start talking about our team, and we did all that, and it was a really fun podcast. We had an SB unfurled to kind of go over some of his the metrics he has on the players, but it turned out the roster was not quite over, and I think it's over now. What had happened? I think this wasn't even on the I had put this on the USC Hoops .com board when Kevin Patton Jr. visited. This is a couple weeks back. You know, shortly in advance of his commitment, on the same day he visited, we actually got a visit for Wesley Yates III. Now, Yates is an interesting situation because he has not played college basketball yet. He's not a freshman. He's not an incoming freshman in the sense that he's class of 2023. He will be a freshman because he has never played, but he's class of 2022. And he didn't play this past season because he had some sort of foot injury. And I'm not sure of the status of that is. I know it kept him out all season. I do know that going into last season, you know, Washington, the end of the Mike Hopkins era at Washington was kind of an odd one where he'd kind of given up on just like developing teams from high school recruits based upon you know, the fit of what he was trying to build with the program. If it had like the Syracuse connection with the 2-3 zone, and just was kind of just going out there and recruiting a lot of mercenaries, essentially. Got Keon Brooks, obviously, for Kentucky. Even when he lost Keon Minifield, interestingly, to Musset at Arkansas, he replaced him with Sevier Wheeler from Kentucky. One of the players that was destined to come in last season was this Wesley Yates. He was supposed to be kind of the centerpiece of that recruiting class that they brought in last season. I know that if you were to go on the Washington boards prior to this past season, they were like, that was like their guy. They were fixated on him. He was a late commit. I think he didn't actually commit to them until latter part of last spring. When he finally came in, they were like, this guy is going to be a really central piece for us. And I think that thinking was that he was going to start at guard and play, you know, 30 minutes a game. Now, none of that happened. Obviously, he never got to play. He is not a top 20 recruit, but he was a, you know, he's basically rated right around number 50 nationally by all the services, except for ESPN, which has him slightly higher, 37 for class of 2022. You can look at his highlights. We have him linked to the on the USCHoops.com board. He played for Beaumont High School in Texas. You know, had success at that level in Texas that he was playing. One of the top players in the state for his class. I will say that he looks really good. He's not super long. So it's not like he's a 6'6 shooting guard. He's kind of like a 6'3 shooting guard. He's really a bucket getter. He can score and he can shoot. Shot pretty well in EYBL, Nike, the top level Nike AAU, about 35% from three. The interesting thing about his recruitment is that it's not that just he was claiming offers. He actually took official visits to Houston. That's Kelvin Sampson. He took an official visit to Auburn. Obviously, that's Bruce Pearl. He took an official visit to University of Texas. Now, he was claiming offers as well from Baylor and Gonzaga. He didn't take those official visits. He did take an official visit to Stanford. I think he graduated magna cum laude. I think that's on his resume at Washington. So he's a good student. But he was getting he was getting legit top like national programs to come and bring him in for a visit. So this is not like some guy who's like claiming all these great offers, but never actually visits a school and then signs with Washington. Ultimately, I think from what I've heard, the connection was that he just ended up going with his cousin, Quincy Pondexter, who was a former star player at Washington. Played, I think he played high school ball, I believe, with the Lopez Twins, but anyway, in Fresno. But anyway, he went to Washington, was there for, I think, all 4 years, ended up developing into a pretty good player, got some time in the NBA, and then was an assistant coach at Washington with Will Conroy the last couple seasons. He is, if you know, family member with Yates. So that's my understanding of the connection of, and why Yates would be looking to us. Obviously, we already have a full team of 13. I don't know who would be at, there's all this discussion who would be asked to give up a scholarship with this 14th player. I don't know if it's a situation where Yates may actually qualify for an academic scholarship because of his academic standing. I just don't know. I don't want to speculate on that because the NIL could just make up the cost of tuition these days. And we've seen, Oregon football like way over the scholarship limit. So they're basically having, lots and lots of players having to do to it, cover their tuition covered through NIL. So that's a lot there. Do you, Nick, any thoughts on having Yates come in? I guess we could talk a little bit about too, about just the fact that he's putting a, now there's like even more pressure on playing time, but now we get another freshman on the team that if we can have him stick around, we'll have something more solid going forward.
He's a really talented player, and you mentioned some of those AAU stats. He was really efficient from inside the arc in AAU too. So he wasn't, taking a bunch of BS mid-range jumpers. It was more like threes and attacking the rim and the kind of in-between game. He was deadly efficient when he did take a mid-range shot. So lots of free throw numbers look good. Good positional size and athleticism. Can see why these other programs really wanted him out of high school. Obviously, the injury coming back from that's never easy, and we have no college data points at this point for him, so it's tricky to kind of peg him into a rotation slot. But yeah, I think he'll be another guy just competing for minutes, and you get enough talented guys, if a few of them flop and a few of them hit, you can have a pretty solid rotation there.
Jason, just in the context of just the size of our roster now, I was there is some interesting things going on with other programs and with all the players left in the transfer portal, and this is by way of example, Coleman Hawkins, who was in the NBA draft and pulled out, really second best player for Illinois this past season, valuable guy, stretch four, can really actually play kind of a point four. He was looking at a number of programs. I think he wanted the same money that Greg Osabar got, this $2 million deal. And Louisville pulled out of the sweepstakes for him. I think they didn't want to pay him. And now he's down to looking for looking at, from what I understand, SMU, Annie Enfield, and Kansas State. And I only bring that up in connection with Wesley Yates to say, people might be asking, why is Yates coming to SC when SC is already so full? But I think there is just so many, there was such a glut of players on the market that Yates may not have trusted that other schools would be able to kind of fit him in on a long-term basis. That's just one thought I had. And, I do, you could look on the Discord that Trilly Donovan has. I know a lot of schools mentioned Yates over time, but there was never any indication that Yates was taking visits to any other schools.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of, when I follow other sports and from the pro ranks, right? And you see a guy that's coming off an injury and heads right into it, an injury in a contract year and ends up as a free agent. And what you often see in those cases is they'll take a short term, less than market value deal, right? Like 1 year for the prove it deal or the show me deal, right? And that may be what we have here. You know, he's got the family connection on staff, obviously. You know, but it's going to be tough for other schools to give him a substantial NIL package without seeing how he recovers from that injury. So it may be the case that, you know, he comes back here for a year. We'll see, you know, how he fits into this rotation. And at least he can get some tape, get his health back, and then kind of reassess. But to your guys' earlier point, you know, this is another body that has eligibility into the future in a roster stacked with seniors and grad transfers. Now, all of a sudden, with, you know, Kevin Patton being added, Yates being added, you've got the two freshmen and Shelly and Elohim. Desmond Claude has another year if he wants it. You know, you can see like a nucleus forming where maybe we don't need to get 13 new players next year, but that number shrinks down to 7 or 8, and the staff can be a little bit more focused and selective for what they do in the portal, especially with fewer COVID years and grad transfers moving forward.
Yeah, I have to say, Nick, I think it's almost maybe more impressive what Muss was able to do at the kind of end of this cycle as far as bringing in some guys for the future, where it looked like initially it looked like he was just shooting for those, you know, guys with no eligibility left after this season, and we'll do another complete rebuild starting next season. And, you know, maybe we sacrificed the true point guard or the rim protector, but he did kind of leave us now. If we're able to hold on to these players, we do have a core for next season that actually looks a lot better than what the core was going to look like when Andy was heading into this past offseason.
Yeah, it's a really interesting core, and you know, just kind of thinking through this, piggybacking off of Jason's point a little bit on Wesley Yates with the prove-it year. My initial thought was, you know, why are we getting all these freshmen when they're just going to be buried and they're not going to get any PT, and then they can just hit the portal after the year, right? I think that's, you know, a natural way to think about it. But if they have no tape, like, what substantial NIL offers are going to be out there for a Jalen Shelley or an Isaiah Elohim if they're not getting on the floor at USC? So USC is going to have the like true evaluation there. They're going to see those kids in practice for a year, and they can decide, okay, this kid's a building block. This kid's not a building block. You know, we can tell him to leave or process him or, you know, whatever verbiage you want to use, tell them to transfer down, whatnot. But, you know, they're going to have all the intel on these kids with, you know, them being in the system for a year and having a year's worth of practice tape on them.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. I should also mention that in the past, you know, week plus, there was kind of some more interesting news with a player that did not end up at USC, but that's Jamari Phillips, who had been, you know, a signee with Arizona, kind of their early recruiting class for 2024, really strong in there. And because of a lot of developments with Arizona, including Caleb Love returning, and I think KJ Lewis is returning as well. It's not been established, right? That's something we would just be discussing a lot more if Arizona was still in our conference, but they're not, so it's not quite as interesting information. But it did cause players to leave the Arizona class, and Jamari Phillips was one of them. He was kind of left in the same screwy situation where he didn't have a ton of options. He ended up taking a visit. Well, I should say before he took that visit, there were a lot of rumors that he was going to be looking at USC. And at the time, before it had broken out that Wesley Yates was actually this 14th guy, the assumption was that the 14th guy was Jamari Phillips. It turns out, no, we had Yates all along. He was the one who's coming into the class. And I think the coaches did not want to go. I mean, they were willing to go beyond 13. They were not willing to go beyond 14. So they did not really bring a reach out to Phillips to bring him in for a visit. He ended up taking a visit to Oregon. He just committed today. So he's going to be at Oregon. Now we will be facing him because he'll be in the Big Ten. He would have been an interesting kind of piece for the future as well. But I mean, you can well understand why you want to take a 15th guy, because it's, you know, you start to just get to the point where it's not even realistic that guys get minutes. You know, one thing we really wanted to be getting into, and this has been Jason's idea, is like, let's really dig deep into this roster. I think, you know, we've discussed the players and several prior podcasts. Let's really get deep and talk about what are the strengths and weaknesses are going to be with the roster as it presents. So first off, let's talk about who's on the team. Okay, so the guards we have, and I would call these guards, and I think we have a discussion about what qualifies as a guard, what doesn't qualify as a guard. I will say that I think the guards are Desmond Claude, Clark Slockert, Bryce Pope, Wesley Yates. And then I would say that the forwards, and I use this as either a wing or, you know, a post, but realistically, these guys are mostly wing guys. The forwards are St. Thomas, Kevin Patton, Elijah Elohim, Terrence Williams, Matt Noling, Jalen Shelley, Chibuzo Agbo. And then the quote-unquote bigs are Josh Cohen, Rashawn Agee, and Harrison Hornery. I will say that Muss was on, did an interview with John Rothstein just a couple days ago on his podcast. He identified Cohen as a five and Agee. I'm not even sure I'm pronouncing that name right. It might be Agee, but Agee as a four. So Cohen is a five, Agee is a four, leaving the door open for them playing at the same time. So that all being said, Jason, do you kind of agree or disagree in parts with my kind of depiction of the positions that these guys play?
Generally, yes. I think the only one where I might bucket it slightly differently, but I totally can see why you did it, would be Chibuzo Agbo. I think that there is a chance that you see him playing the two, quote unquote. But to your point, Chase, and to the point that Coach Musk made on John Rothstein's podcast, and I would encourage everybody to listen to that if you haven't already, there are like eight guys he named that he sees playing multiple positions this year. And so pretty much everyone in that middle category, St. Thomas, Patton, Elohim, Williams, Noling, Shelley, Agbo, are all guys that have the flexibility to play up or down a slot or two in the lineup if they need to. So yeah, I think, you know, Desmond Claude, it sounds like, is really going to be used as a primary ball handler, which is not a role that he played at Xavier, but it seems like that's the way that it's trending right now. We know there's an absence of a true point guard on the roster, and so it makes sense. And then from there, you know, there's different ways that you can fill out a starting lineup and a depth chart. I know, Chase, you've got some theories on that as well for how you find a starting backcourt. You know, and then obviously you've got the bigs with Cohen, Agee, and Harry. And another thing that Musk said in that interview is that, you know, he understands basically that we're going to be playing small or undersized at the five whenever Josh Cohen isn't in the game, because there isn't a true other center on the roster at this point. Which leads me to believe, by the way, that Josh Cohen is going to be playing a lot of minutes. So yeah, I think it's a lot of versatility kind of in the middle of the lineup that gives Coach Moss a lot of options to set the lineup as he sees fit.
Yeah, where are you with on this, Nick?
Yeah, I think Jason made kind of the key point there on Cohen, combined with, you know, Chase, your point that Agee is more of a four than a five, is that Cohen's probably going to be playing 30 plus minutes a game. So that was my key takeaway there. Claude, I think you're looking at 30 plus minutes just because he's, you know, the primary ball handler. And you might have a few guys get squeezed in that, you know, two to four range. I think Agbo is going to have to play some two. But yeah, I mean, I think a really nice benefit of having the depth on the roster is it just gives you more outs, right? You know, more versatility, more outs, ability to withstand injury, you know, ability to, you know, stay afloat if a guy doesn't translate well from low major to high major. So really like that aspect of it.
If you go back and look at the teams that Musk put together at Arkansas once he arrived, they're interesting because, you know, he made the Elite Eight twice in those 2 years, and he didn't really use a really deep bench those years. So going back to the 2021 season, so this is when he makes the run into the Elite Eight before running, and this is obviously our year when we're in the you know, the kind of the post-COVID year when we make it to the Elite Eight as well with Evan Mobley. They got a little bit of a benefit because Oral Roberts made it to the – that was with Max Asmus. They made it to the Sweet 16. So Arkansas got to play them in the round of 16 and made it to the Elite Eight. And then they ran into Baylor, which is obviously a tough one. But they played fairly competitive against Baylor. So that was the team – that team had JD and Note, and it had Justin Smith, who had been a transfer from Indiana that Musk brought in. But, you know, the big name on that team was Moses Moody, who was just a freshman. They had Devo Davis, who seems to be on all these teams. And then they had, like, guys like Desi Sills, who had been at Arkansas before Musk. He brought in Vance Jackson, who, I mean, that's really going way back for USC fans. I think Vance Jackson had like four different opportunities to transfer to USC. Started at UConn. I mean, this is going way, way, way back. And but so that was a team that, you know, you didn't really, you know, a lot of the heavy minutes there are being played by Moody and Smith, Jalen Tate, who is a transfer from Northern Kentucky. You know, it was probably like a legitimate 9-man rotation, but, you know, that included like giving 10 minutes to Vance Jackson, things like that. The next season is probably, you know, Muss's real, his best team. This is the one that knocked off Gonzaga in the round of 16 and ended up losing to Duke, the Duke team that had Paolo Banchero in the round of 8. And that had Note again, but he had brought in Stanley Amude from South Dakota. And Jalen Williams, who was actually, I believe, was on the team the year before and in the rotation, but not as big of a minute cutter. This is the Jalen Williams that's the kind of the crazy hair, but it takes all the charges, but a really, really tremendous defensive player. And that team also was not like super, Note's playing 33 minutes a game. They brought in Adise Tony from Pitt. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name right, but he's kind of a guy who's just kind of a scrappy guy around the rim. He played 32 minutes a game. Jalen Williams played 32 minutes a game. It was really that next season, the team that didn't make the Elite Eight, they made the Sweet 16. And that's the team that had like just, you know, he just went all out, basically brought in the whole world, right? So he has the three McDonald's All-Americans that were all one and tons. Anthony Black, Nick Smith, Jordan Walsh, gets Ricky Council, transfers in from Wichita State, was really tremendous early in the season for them. He's an NBA guy now. They get a transfer in from Trayvon Brazil from Missouri. I mean, this is a team that really, you know, Brazil ended up getting hurt this season, but like just kind of was like, you know, popping off the screen, and you watch them on television, you're like, oh my gosh. Like a complete rebuild of a roster, but just tons and tons of talent. It was so weird because even like Jalen Smith, who Nick and I have liked a lot at Arizona State, transfers there as a big and basically is struggling to get minutes just because of the amount of talent on that roster. Now, they had problems with, you know, Trayvon Brazil obviously got hurt, but Nick Smith was hurt for a good portion of the season. He comes back toward the end. They never really got it together. In the regular season, they actually had a losing record in the SEC, but the SEC was so strong, they made the tournament. They knock off Illinois in 8-9 game. Then they beat Kentucky, number one seed Kentucky, in the second round, which brings them into the round of 16. Unfortunately, they run into eventual national champion in UConn, and that was kind of a blowout game. But just looking at all that, like it wasn't really until more the last couple seasons, and I've skipped this past season, where Muss is like brought in rosters where he's looking to go really deep, it looks like. Before he didn't have, and what do you think, Jason? Do you think this is a raw, is he prepared to really say, I've got 10 guys on my roster who are going to play at least 10 minutes per game? Do you think that's what's going to end up happening?
Ooh, that's a tough question because, right, the track record suggests that he'll hone in on the starters and ride them a little bit. But I also just don't – I think this roster is really unprecedented in terms of what he's had at his disposal. There's just so many guys that have experience that I think you will see a lot of guys kind of in that 8 to 12 minute range. So it may be, you know, semantics, right? It's like how many guys are going to play. A lot of guys are going to play, but in terms of who's over or under that 10 minute threshold, it's going to be pretty close.
So Nick, this past season, and we haven't even, I didn't really get to the whole roster there. That's a whole another story, but a complete rebuild again. But 11 guys now. So some of these guys are not playing. They're not playing every game, but 11 guys played 13 minutes or more minutes per game for Mus in games they played this past season. And then you have a guy like Joseph Pinion. Who you know you might who thought he would get minutes. He like barely plays. Bayfall barely plays. What do you think Mus is going to have to do to differentiate what happened with that 20, you know, the 2023-24 roster with Arkansas versus this roster he's put together here?
You know, I hope the players are better, I think, as a starting point. Yeah, like you look at some of the guys that he had on that Arkansas team. And, you know, I was never a fan of L. Ellis at Louisville. Chandler Lawson, you know, we saw him at Oregon for a couple of years. He was kind of just a guy and turned into more like a, you know, really key rotation piece last year for Arkansas, just because I think they were looking for answers on the inside, and Devo Davis had a really crappy shooting year. So they kind of like had a, you know, everything that could go wrong went wrong with that team. But you know, I do think the skill level on this USC roster is just a cut above that Arkansas team. So, you know, I think you'll have the first, you know, month or two, I think it'll be a test run. I think the minutes will be pretty, you know, evenly spaced out, and you'll have guys, you know, rise and become key rotation pieces, and you know, other guys won't perform as well, and I think they'll fall out of favor. But you know, I don't think that's going to get settled immediately. But I would be surprised if by like tournament time we're rolling out like a 12-man rotation. I don't think that's going to happen.
Do you, Jason, do you put any credence in? I mean, looks like, I know this is said as a cliche a lot, but this seems legitimately the case that Mus has gone out of his way to recruit like good academic students. I know Bryce Pope had received some sort of academic honor at UC San Diego. I'll go and figure out what that is. Slacker obviously played at Penn. Noling played at Yale. We know that Yates was a magna cum laude at his high school. It seems to me, now this doesn't apply to I think every single player on the roster, but like it seems to me that it was very important to Mus in putting together this team that he had guys that he perceives. Oh, actually, Kevin Patton is another one I think that was had like a 4.0 or whatever at San Diego. He put together a roster of guys that he perceives as being very high character guys. And I think that maybe that's as a reflection of what happened last season with at Arkansas, where, and I don't want to call any players, but just as an example, I know they were counting on Keon Minifield being their point guard, and he shows up and he's not eligible. So he can't start the season, and he never really recovered from that. So, is it seem like to you that that's was like a real point of emphasis in putting this roster together for him?
Yeah, I think that's really important because of right this USC situation coming in with a blank slate, needing to bring in enough guys to be able to, you know, throw proverbial spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. But also then for the guys that don't stick, like, are you going to cause trouble? Is there going to be dissension in the locker room? Are there going to be chemistry problems? And I think getting a bunch of guys that have experience, are good students, and generally perceived as high character guys mitigates that somewhat, right? If you know that, hey, I played 24 minutes a game last year and I started 30 games, and now I play 8 minutes a game and I don't start at all. Like, is that going to be a problem in the locker room, or am I going to kind of accept my role and make the most of it? And I think Muss has done what he can to find guys that would make the most of it. To the point about depth, I did a just look at the Big Ten in terms of returning productivity. And again, these stats will not make a lot of sense intuitively, but I think it will still prove my point. And the reason why it won't make a lot of sense intuitively is because there's only one basketball, and everybody on your team is obviously going to be playing way fewer minutes than they played previously. But if you just add up the points per game of returning productivity for Big Ten teams, USC returns at this point 152.6 points per game scored last year, right? So I don't think anybody thinks USC is going to average 150 points per game, but that just illustrates how many guys were playing huge minutes at other schools. And by the way, that's more than 30 points per game better than the second best team in the Big Ten in terms of returning scoring from the prior season. And if you look at it in games started, say your regular season, right, is 31 games. Say you have a 4-game postseason, couple games of conference tournament, couple games in March Madness, NIT. You end up at 35 games, right? So 35 games and you have five starters in your lineup. So that's 175 starting slots available in a season. USC is returning 292 starts from last college basketball season. So like the level of depth is not just like adequate, it's like unprecedented. Obviously no continuity whatsoever. All of these guys are brand new, but you look at this roster, maybe the top guys are not the top 5 or 10 players in the Big Ten, but that next level of guys, there's just so many of them that are quality. And if you're trying to play a style, when you get up and down the court and you get into foul fests and wars of attrition, like that plays right into this because your 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys are better than your opponent's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys. So I do think like how this roster was constructed makes sense given, you know, how the team is hoping to play next year stylistically.
Yeah, and building upon that, and we're going to get into some of these numbers in a separate podcast we're going to do for the Big Ten preview. But I asked SB Unfurled if he had his if I mean, we mentioned during that last podcast with him that he had done a kind of a one concrete number rating for all the players in the transfer portal. He calls that his OVR, and it's basically on a scale of 1 to 10. Essentially, some players go over the 10. But it's that's the scale. And I asked him if he had the OVR rating for players that returning players that did not transfer. And he did, and he was kind enough to provide that to us. So I really appreciate that. So I took those numbers and just trying to figure out what the, these projected OVR ratings were for essentially all the players that are projected to play minutes for the 18 teams in the Big Ten next season. I mean, that's a bit of a gargantuan task for a couple of days, but I sat down and did it. And USC doesn't have anyone in the top nine going into next season, but it does have nine of the top 45 players in OVR rating. Now, the OVR rating is supposed to tell you who are the best players. So if you trust SB Unfurled's numbers, USC would be heading into next season. And of course, real life is going to change the circumstances here. We're just talking about as performance to date goes, USC would be heading into next season with nine of the top 45 players in the Big Ten conference, which is, you do the math, 20%, which is well more than one out of 18. And that includes like, the freshmen that are Ace Bailey and Dylan Hunt Harper that are going to Rutgers, these top five players. So I did get some freshmen in on this list as well. So when you look at it and you look on that basis, if you just go by the OVR numbers, like these, projected quality of individual players, SC is actually far and away number one in the conference. Now, I don't think that's necessarily, that's not a necessarily one-to-one translation because you know, teams need to fit together. It's basketball. Teams need to fit together well. Then you're going to have weakness. Individual players are going to have strengths and weaknesses, and you want the players to complement each other. You know, our players have never played together before. That's a part of it. Now, that's going to be the case for a lot of players in the conference next year, obviously, and in all of college basketball. But that's an important aspect of it. coaching matters. All these things matter. But it just goes to show you that, you know, because of the scoring, really, that that Jason just described, SC is really, it looks on paper, very, very strong. And maybe we'll go and start to go in really quickly. And I went through, you know, to do this, the way these ratings went, I had to go and project who I thought were going to get what minutes going into next season. And I could very well be wrong about these. And the way that I had allocated, what, you know, Jason, do you have the way you allocated minutes available real quick?
Yeah, I have it pulled up.
Okay, why don't you tell us how you have it allocated?
Okay, so my starting five was Desmond Claude at the one. I have Ogbo starting at the two. I had Terrence Williams, St. Thomas, Josh Cohen. That's my five. Obviously, those two, three, four, you know, call them whatever position you want. I think Musk doesn't know what position they are. You know, they're multi-positional guys, one lead guard and one big. And then what I did from there was, right, I think you talked in depth about what Arkansas had done in terms of how many bench minutes they played the last several years that Musk was there. And so I tried to get kind of a guidepost from that. In terms of what percentage of minutes would be played by those five starters, and then what percentage would go to the bench. And then from there, I tried to make sure that, you know, the five starters hit my number, the bench guys hit the number, and obviously we ended up at the correct number of minutes per game overall. So my allocations for the starters were Josh Cohen, 32 minutes, St. Thomas and Desmond Claude, 30 minutes each. I had Ogbo at 28. I had Terrence Williams at 26. And then in terms of bench guys, I had Matt Noling, 12, Rashawn Eggy, 10, Slackert, 10, Pope, 10, Patton, 8, 2 minutes each for Elohim and Shelley, and none allocated to Hornery. Obviously, you add Wesley Yates into the mix. I have not even figured out what to do with him. So if we give him a few minutes, you're pulling on the margins there. But that's generally how I saw it shake out.
Yeah, mine were really, really similar. I obviously had not rated Yates. I didn't give any minutes to Shelley or Elohim. I just wasn't sure what to do there. I think the biggest discrepancy in our numbers was I had done my minutes before I listened to that podcast, and I only gave Cohen 22. I gave Iggy 18. I think in listening to that podcast, I would definitely give more to Cohen now. Otherwise, I think Slacker was the other one that had the he and Terrence Williams. I know Terrence Williams is only getting about 18 minutes. I don't know if that's going to be the case or not. We'll see about that. And Slacker and I had actually an 18, but we'll see. But otherwise, almost right on. I mean, very similar otherwise. Claude 31, St. Thomas 31, Agbo 28. I mean, very similar. So on that basis, I fill around with the stats and look like, okay, well, what if these guys actually got these minutes and they performed exactly on a per minute basis like they did last season? And what would that look like for the team? Well, the funny thing is, if you compare it to like USC last season, the field goal percentage is similar. The 2-point field goal percentage is better. It's 53.2%, which is, last season I think USC was right around 50%. Maybe I'll pull up here just, you know, national numbers on KenPom for some of this stuff. But so 53.2% 2-point field goal percentage, 35.3% 3-point percentage. Where would that? KenPom expired. We'll have to look at, you know, pretty respectable national numbers. I don't think it would be top 10 at those spots, but it'd be pretty high up. Offensive rebounding, defensive rebound, it's defensive rebound slightly better. Assists slightly less, turnovers just slightly less. Not as many blocks, which is not a surprise, and not quite as many steals. But where the big difference is points. Whereas USC last season scored somewhere with 74 points per game. I think that's the number. Let's see. 74 points per game. These players, if allocated, you know, if they score, if they were to get these minutes and get it scoring the same rate as last season, they'd be scoring 96.6 points per game. So it's a little bit higher percentage, but it's higher volume and faster pace. Now, none of that's going to work out perfectly, but it is kind of an interesting benchmark to see. Okay, so assists are a little bit down, turnovers are down, but and points is way up, which is not surprising. So that's, you know, free throw percentage, for I know for all you who care, number one, about that, over 75%. So you guys would be happy about that. So all that on that, all looking at all these data points, Nick, what are your thoughts on what are from the roster we have and the team that we're going to put out there next season on the court? What do you see as the strengths and the weaknesses as it currently stands?
So I know you mentioned free throw percentage, and you know, you kind of scoff at it, right? Because the casual fan will look at free throws and lean into that as a reason that you win or lose games when it really shouldn't be. But I think it's absolutely relevant in trying to project players' strengths and weaknesses moving forward, and maybe project it into a new system, right? So you look at, you know, a guy like Bryce Pope, right? Bryce Pope was not a very efficient scorer last year. He had a 52% true shooting at the low major level, but he shot 82% from the line. And you look at his shot quality at UCSD, and he had to take a lot of tough late clock shots because there was no other primary guy on that team that could go get a bucket. So I think his shot quality in the USC system next year as more of a role player will be substantially higher. And given what he shot from the line, I think Bryce Pope will be able to make a catch and shoot three. So you see lots of examples like that on our team next year. St. Thomas was, you know, over 85% from the line, and he had to do everything for that Northern Colorado team. Claude, I think same way at Xavier, I think he's a much better shooter than he shot from three. You know, and the same applies for these guys on mid range twos. So, you know, I kind of think we're going to be a substantially better shooting team than, you know, the 2-point percentages and 3-point percentages showed, at least for these guys at their stops last year. So I think we're going to be a very good shooting team. You look at the turnover rates, by and large, they're very low for all these guys, which is what you would expect given how experienced they are. So I kind of think in terms of turnovers and offensive efficiency, we're going to be very strong. Where I think we're weaker is just on the overall athleticism and defensive side, which is, you know, that's why when Jason mentioned on a prior pod, you know, he sees us as a top 10 or 15 offense, but in his numbers, we were a sub top 100 defense. I think that's a lot more valid than if you just look at the Bart Korvic rankings, which has us like, I think, you know, 30 or so on offense and defense.
What are your thoughts on all this, Jason?
Yeah, I want to echo a lot of what you guys said. I think we're in pretty good lockstep in terms of strengths and weaknesses. As I ran down the strengths, I think, right, the foul game, free throw game, both drawing them and shooting them. I know we talked about percentages, but just like in terms of getting to the line, Josh Cohen has an exceptionally high free throw rate. Terrence Williams, Desmond Claude, also very good at drawing them. And then in terms of percentages, right, Josh Cohen, probably the worst of the five starters, still shot 69.6% from the line on very high volume. So I just did an exercise where, like, if you add up the total free throws shot by all the projected starters last year, and that would allow you to weight kind of roughly who you think is going to be shooting more or less of them, that total comes out to 76.3%. That would have ranked 35th nationally last year. So Foul game, very strong. We're, you know, must emphasizes in every interview and press conference that he does. Like, we will be at, you know, top five in the country in getting to the line, and we've got a ton of guys that make them. So that part of the offense, if you think about like the four factors of offense in terms of, you know, shooting for effective field goal percentage, and then, you know, offensive rebounding, turnovers, and the free throw rate, right? Free throw rate, excellent. Shooting, as you guys said, shooting should be above average. Especially 3-point shooting. I think four of the five starters nationally are ranked by KenPom in true shooting, as individuals, driven by, you know, Chibuzo Agbo, and Terrence Williams, I believe, also being high volume 40% 3-point shooter, right? And then both of those guys, and then you know, Josh Cohen and St. Thomas both shooting 57% inside the arc. So I think shooting's good, right? So now we've checked the box on effective field goal percentage. We've checked the box on free throw rate. And now you want to talk about turnovers, right? This team will take pretty good care of the ball in terms of not shooting itself in the foot with turnovers, because I just looked at last year's USC starters and this year's projected USC starters, and just did a side by side or a draft of kind of who's turning the ball over the most. Last year's USC team would have had the top three guys and who turns the ball over the most: Isaiah Collier, Kobe Johnson, Josh Morgan. All of them had a higher turnover rate than anyone that will start for USC this year. So now you've checked three of the four factors. And I think the big question mark for me, if I'm looking at offensive efficiency, is going to be rebounding. Rebounding on this team, I think it should be fine. I think you only have a few truly standout guys. That'd be St. Thomas, that'd be Josh Cohen, and Rashawn Aggie. But we will have size advantages over almost everyone we play, you know, other than at the five, where you've got Josh Cohen, who's, you know, perfectly adequate. And you may be a little, you know, undersized at the four, depending who's in the game at the moment. But, you know, at the guard spots, we're going to be humongous. So there should be the ability to be a strong rebounding team. But I think that would be kind of, if I'm doing strengths and weaknesses and maybe like a middle to be determined column, I think rebounding is kind of going to be one of the make or break things on the offensive side of the ball. And then the last thing as a strength would be depth, which we talked about pretty extensively, just in terms of how much talent there is on this team, kind of as you get deeper and deeper into the roster.
I do wonder on with the rebounding if we're going to have to play two of St. Thomas, Rashawn Agee, and Josh Cohen at all times. Have two of them, two of those three on the court. Like, I don't think we can actually guarantee that. But I mean, for defensive rebounding, St. Thomas and Rashawn Agee are like two of the best players in the country. I mean, literally, like, I think, but like both like top 10, maybe, in a defense rebounding percentage. After that, you do kind of slip, you know. Noling is decent. And Patton is decent on the defensive rebounding. Neither is quite as good on offensive boards. Cohen is better on the offensive boards. The other guys, you know, a guy like, you know, Agbo, you'd like to see him, frankly, have a little bit better rebound numbers. But if he's going to be playing the two, I guess that's acceptable. That's just some thoughts I have. One of the interesting things to me is, I mean, there's so many like little aspects to our team. I do, me personally, I have a feeling that, notwithstanding that maybe, you know, we'll have Agbo starting at the two with Terrence Williams and St. Thomas at 3-4. I do wonder if so, Musk said something on the podcast that he talked about Pope being a two and Slacker being a one. And I do wonder if there's going to be like a competition between those two guys to see who's excelling at his position more. Slacker as a one, Pope as a two, and whoever is excelling more will start with being paired with Claude. I don't know that for sure. And maybe Claude will just start with, let's say, Agbo in the backcourt. But I have a feeling that's the case. And I thought that before, when we brought Patton in, and now I think after Muscle's comments, I think that might still be the case, but I just don't know. I Muscle might not know. He might be waiting to see what happens. One of the interesting comments that Bus made, Nick, is that he does not like secret scrimmages, which was music to my ears because I don't like see the point of secret scrimmages either. He wants to play exhibition games, which are public. They can actually be televised under certain circumstances. So I actually think this team is really tailor-made for like exhibition games because you'd want to get everyone out on the court and see what it looks like. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's great because, especially when you're in a city like Los Angeles and USC has struggled to draw historically over the last 20 years here or since Galen was open, that's a chance to put your product on the floor and, give the media and give the fans a taste of what the season could look like. So I think that preview is great. And I think back, to a few years when they had that exhibition against Villanova. I think it was Ethan Anderson's freshman year. Must have been 20, gosh,
2019.
2019.
Yep,
Yeah,
I was there.
2019. Yeah, so I was too before I knew you. But yeah,
Yeah.
great environment. I think the cause was they were raising money for the wildfires in California at
They
the
were,
time.
that's
So
right.
like
Yeah.
they made it a charitable event. Got good turnout. You had like even Villanova fans that showed up that were in LA. Some of them showed up for that too. So it was just an all around really cool event. And Arkansas, even though they had the down year this past year, they had one of those exhibitions where they beat Purdue and got a lot of national praise for it. And, deservedly so. Purdue was a great team, ended up going to the championship. So I just don't see the downside. And I think there's a lot of upside in showcasing your products at a school which hasn't historically really supported its teams.
Yeah, and notwithstanding Arkansas beating Purdue not exactly being the greatest harbinger of those two teams' respective
Yeah.
success the last season, there were some interesting exhibitions. Tennessee really took it to Gonzaga bad, and there were a couple others I can't remember offhand, but there were really high-level matchups. Michigan State really struggled in an exhibition game, and they struggled during the season. So anyway, I'm saying all that. Jason, do you have an opinion on exhibitions versus secret scrimmages?
I love the idea of exhibitions. I think it's almost no downside, right? Like you want to see who's gonna perform when the lights are on and the cameras are on, right? Like that's what it's all about. Like get in front of real people with real pressure, Secret scrimmage, could almost be like analogous to a practice setting. How many times in the past have we heard, from the Enfield staff about, who was shooting the lights out in practice, and then they'd get in the game, and it's like, what happened? It's like it's just different when you're live. And the other reason why I love the idea of this is just when you have a roster of 14 and you're going to have this crunch for minutes and for playing time, you need every possible outlet to let these guys prove out who will or won't perform, right? Like, if I think about, what I would be doing if I were a member of this staff, I would be charting every live situation in practice from the very first practice all the way through the season, just to see all these different lineup combinations. If you've only got seven or eight guys to begin with, you can't really have great live periods in practice, but when you've got 14 of them, you can. But you also have the challenge of then sorting out a depth chart. So, like, to find the two-man and three-man and four-man and five-man units that work the best is going to be really like what it's all about in this off-season period, to try to come into the season with a better idea of those minute allocation numbers that Chase and I took a shot in the dark at. But with all of the data from all of the practice and especially these exhibition games right before the season starts, I think that can be really, really invaluable in terms of giving the staff a head start on figuring out how they want to play this throughout the season.
So I think we're gonna change topics really abruptly here because Nick wants to cover kind of an interesting rumor that surfaced on Twitter. It's almost like a puzzle that surfaced on Twitter. And so I'm just gonna hand it over to you, Nick, and you can just talk about this tweet and how it talks about potential further realignment in college sports.
Yeah, so obviously this has nothing to do with USC basketball this upcoming year, but I don't think we're done with the realignment game. Our friend MHVER3 on Twitter, who we've talked about in the past, this guy was the guy that had all the inside intel on realignment a few years ago with the Big Ten and the Pac-12 blowing up. So he kind of like cryptically tweeted the other day, a little riddle, and it was ACC, two become villains so that four may depart. Blood on the hands of the best football brands. For the two public Ivies, not a drop. Two travel north, two travel south. One left behind that even shocks me. Over your mark comes the vulture to pick the bones. And then he said, to the west, the lonely two, a small reunion may ensue. When the tree and the bear come back as a pair with a pony in tow, those five will seek to grow. So, it's almost like you're reading a Dr. Seuss book or something like with this. But it was very cryptic. He actually said that he said two public Ivies, but he mentioned that one of those is actually a private Ivy wannabe. So at least, we kind of exchanged the messages offline about it. And it seems like Florida State and Clemson are as good as gone from the ACC. So I think those two teams you can pencil in either to the SEC or the Big Ten. But then trying to like figure out those other two, the public Ivy and the kind of like, Ivy wannabe that was actually a private school. We kind of took that to mean North Carolina and Miami. I think North Carolina is pretty well documented, high quality academic institution that's public. And Miami is a good school. It's a private school that lots of people think is a public school, which kind of gives credence to the theory that MHVER probably thought of it as a public school when he tweeted that out initially and then made the mistake and corrected. So long story short, I don't think there's anything imminent on this front. But it seems like we're not done with the conference realignment situation and that the ACC is kind of in trouble here.
Yeah, so where do you okay, the two travel north, two travel south. Now and the other school I don't think you mentioned we would be Virginia would have to be in the mix here as well, right?
Yeah.
So where what's the what it's the what's the best, right now teasing out of what are the two that are going to the Big Ten, and what are the two that are going to the SEC?
I guess that's the million-dollar question, right? So I think you look at geographically, you would think maybe Clemson's a natural SEC fit with it being in the same state as South Carolina. But then that would mean that, if we got the four teams right, it would mean that one of Miami or Florida State would go Big Ten. I kind of think that like Miami being, a top 50 academic school might fit more in the Big Ten than the SEC from that standpoint. But then again, you have the whole, is Florida State comfortable going to the SEC after the SEC basically screwed them out of a playoff berth last year, for all intents and purposes? So I'm not sure. I think North Carolina, the Big Ten makes a lot of sense on paper to me, but maybe they end up going SEC and you got like Miami and Florida State going to the Big Ten traveling north. So that's one piece I haven't solved, and I guess we'll just have to see it play out.
Jason, have you tried to solve this riddle at all?
Yeah, I'm pretty close with Nick on all of this. The other piece of it that we were trying to figure out was all the stuff about, trees and bears or whoever are going back west, right? Like that one seems a little bit more,
On the
obvious to figure out
nose.
what the teams are that we're talking about. But then it's like, well, what does that mean? And then it says the lonely two, which we thought was Oregon State and Washington State being the two leftover Pac-12, Pac-2, whatever you want to call it, schools, right? And if the Big 12 has already picked over the carcass of the ACC, and these guys are now left back on their own again. You know, they those three schools, SMU, Stanford, and Cal, going back with Oregon State and Washington State to kind of resuscitate the pack, whatever, would be kind of an interesting byproduct of all this as well.
Yeah, that would, and it would be a bit of a, you know, SMU, Cal, and Stanford have somewhat of a synthesis that you kind of see, but we may kind of the forced repairing of with Oregon State and Washington State is a bit odd. I guess, you know, I think the big thing is, right, if there's, is it going to be the case that, well, let me take a step. Who do we think, if we're going to rank, let's say, the top five most valuable programs in the ACC as currently constituted, like, who would you want the most? Like, how would you rank those, Nick?
I would say Miami, North Carolina, and Florida State would be my top three.
Interesting. Okay.
I'd like four and five, probably you'd go like Clemson and Virginia, I guess, in some order, but I think those are a little behind the other two
Okay.
or other
Now,
three.
and by the way, the argument for Virginia, just so everyone understands, is it's the there are no other competing schools in, and this would be the case for North Carolina. There are no other competing schools within those states in either the Big Ten or the SEC. So if North Carolina breaks away from Duke and NC State and Wake Forest, and Virginia breaks away from Virginia Tech, and goes to either the SEC or the Big Ten, you're going to have the marquee program now from the two, not only two highly talented states, but two like growing states. So they're both kind of sought after. How would you, where would you be with the rankings on these, Jason?
Pretty close. I think Florida State probably is up there in North Carolina. It's interesting talking about Virginia, right? It's certainly the better academic school in the state. I think Virginia Tech probably has the football history, or Virginia has the basketball history. You know, I could go either way on those. But yeah, I mean, you can see how if this thing does implode with a couple of the marquee brands off the top, like what you're left with is, you know, not much, right? And so then the Big 12 comes and picks it off. You can see it disintegrating pretty fast if you lose those top brands, because
Yeah.
this is a big conference, right? And so then you lose those top schools. Now all of a sudden you're like looking at a conference that's like, you know, Georgia Tech and Louisville and NC State and Syracuse, and it's just like, you know, Boston College. Like, I don't know.
Well, those are a bunch of schools that, if you go back even to the 90s, were not really affiliated with major conferences. I guess NC State would be the exception, but,
It's all the Big East schools, right?
right. Well, Big E, I mean, the Big East was formed essentially right around 1980 for to represent Northeast schools that just couldn't find conference homes. And that was Syracuse, Boston College, for sure. And then over time, the ones with the better football programs, like Penn State, who didn't actually make the Big East because their basketball program wasn't strong enough, found homes in the Big Ten. Oh, you know what? Let me bring up one more thing, because this is tangentially kind of connected, because there is a Notre Dame connection to the ACC, and the ACC is truly falling apart. I rarely would do this because I don't think this is like a serious discussion amongst USC fans at all. But like, there is a point to be made here. Colin Cowherd brought up that USC should drop Notre Dame from its schedule, and you know, from time to time, I've floated with that idea in the past. Just because I thought the game really benefited Notre Dame a lot more than it does USC. But that's going to be like going forward, like really particularly the case that this game is going to be far more valuable for Notre Dame than it is for USC. I mean, USC is going to be playing marquee teams from big programs from the Midwest already. It doesn't necessarily need to play Notre Dame every year. Notre Dame has stubbornly refused to join a conference. Refused to join and really associated themselves with a much weaker football conference in the ACC, refused to join the Big Ten. And there hasn't really been too many consequences for them, the choice to do that. I do wonder if it's been a poor choice all along, because I think it's still like Notre Dame still hasn't won like a major bowl game for like 25 years. I mean, they've made the college football playoff and still like gone out in the first round. So I don't know how serious it is to take this, like, oh, drop Notre Dame from the schedule, because I don't think it's going to happen or is even close to happening. But I mean, is it, does it, you know, if we were really starting all over USC scheduling, does it make sense that USC would be just like, just kind of dogmatically schedule Notre Dame every season given the new realities? What do you think about that, Nick?
I think a lot of it's a generational thing too, right? Like if you talk to USC alums, maybe like 60 or older, a lot of them have a lot of fond memories of USC Notre Dame games over the years. Like I know, you know, my dad was at that Anthony Davis game where they were down big at halftime. He had the kickoff return. They blitzed them in the second half, and that was part of his upbringing. But you know, at least in my position, I see no reason to continuing play that game just because essentially you're subsidizing Notre Dame's football program. Because Notre Dame, they're relying on, you know, Big Ten teams and ACC teams to play them for them to get that NBC exclusive TV deal. So I don't understand why, you know, you're giving them this lifeline and, you know, then by not joining your conference, that limits your TV deal. I mean, you know, obviously the Fox media rights deal is astronomical compared to what we've seen in the past. But imagine if you had Notre Dame as a Big Ten team instead of Minnesota, right? That TV deal would be even larger. So, yeah, like I think, like you mentioned, it benefits Notre Dame way more than USC. You can make the case for playing the game, you know, if you want to just eliminate the money considerations from it and just say, this game is so important to our fan base in ways, you know, for non-monetary reasons. But if you're just looking at it from an ROI money standpoint, you know, money that you can dump into your program and invest in other ways, I wouldn't play the game.
What are your thoughts on this, Jason, this issue?
I don't know. At a certain point, I just do like a sanity check and say, like, what are we even doing here? Like, it's USC Notre Dame. Come on, like, we're gonna play this game, right? Like, it's our biggest football rival. Like, you have to play that game. And like, now, everything that Nick said makes perfect sense to me. Like, logically, like, business standpoint, you know, maybe there's some concessions or a deal that can be reached. But you're right. It benefits Notre Dame more than USC to keep the game on the schedule, but I don't think either fan base is going to be happy to see it go, right? So what then gets called into question is, okay, so USC is now going to play 9 Big Ten games. SEC plays 8 conference games, and most of your SEC schools are playing 4 cupcakes, right? So they've got 8 real games in the season, and USC's like contractually obligated to 10 before anything even happens. And unfortunately, like I mean, this is going to be the first year where the playoff committee is going all the way down to 12 in terms of like actual spots in a bracket. So we'll see how those ratings shake out. But like, I'm not necessarily encouraged by like the composition of those committees and what they have rewarded in the past in terms of, you know, if a team is 8-4 but played a ridiculous schedule versus 10-2 and they played like, you know, an FCS school and 3 cupcakes and 8 SEC games. Like, is the 8-4 team ever going to get consideration with the 10-2 team? Probably not. So, like, you're just kind of like tying an arm behind your back as you're trying to qualify for a college football playoff. And that's pretty tough. So, another thing that I've seen, like, as a fallout of, okay, you're going to keep the Notre Dame game is like maybe USC finally, like, swallows its pride on the we'll never play an FCS school thing because we're now the only school that doesn't play any of those games. But right, if you want to keep Notre Dame on the schedule, maybe the way to do it is you just say, we'll keep Notre Dame every year, but one of these other two games we're playing is going to be like the worst FCS school. We're just going to beat them by 80 points and kind of do what everybody else does to like just eliminate a variable from like having another possible loss on the schedule. So, it's like this is what it is. It's like tradition versus practicality versus the future, right? And just trying to make sense of it all in this, changing landscape here.
And that just to build on that really quickly, that kind of feeds into our whole conversation last year about basketball scheduling, right? Like, why would you ever play one of those quad three games? You get no one gives you any credit for winning those. And yet there's, a ton of downside to losing them. And people kind of view the quad three and the quad four as equivalents, right? So the better way to schedule would just be schedule KenPom teams like 320 through 350, play them at home. Just make sure you have zero chance of losing that game. And I think that feeds right into that. But one other point on the Notre Dame thing is not only do you have Notre Dame this year, you have LSU. So you're playing these two like monster non-conference games to go along with your Big Ten schedule. It's really, really tough for SC this year.
I just want to add on a little bit to the generational argument that Nick was pointing out. And this gives you an idea. From 1964 through 1980, so this is a 17-year span of seasons. In those 17 seasons, Notre Dame finished in the top nine in the AP 12 times. So 12 times in 17 seasons. And during that time period, SC beat Notre Dame. I think in those 12 games, I think they beat him more than six times. So I think SC had a winning record against Notre Dame in seasons where they finished in the top nine. Okay, so just I'm framing that in the terms of how big these games were when SC was playing Notre Dame in those seasons. Where and perfect example is 1964, Notre Dame comes to the Coliseum for the last week of the season. They're undefeated. They're 10-0 or 9-0. Number one in the nation, and USC beats them 20-17. It's a huge win for USC against a really, really good Notre Dame team. And that kind of game happened a lot during that 17-year period to the point that it really, I mean, first of all, it helped establish the McKay, John Robinson brand, but it really helped kind of make USC such a just formal national power that everyone recognized, time immemorial. And people of a certain age remember and have such fond memories of those games where USC and Notre Dame playing in huge national games and USC coming on top. But if you look at what's happened since then, in the handful of games that Notre or the handful of seasons where Notre Dame has actually been good. So since 1980, Notre Dame has finished the season in the top 10. Something like about 10 times 10 times over a period of what whatever 43 years 44 years in those seasons, like USC was like never good in any of those seasons. And the most recent one where we have 2020 where Notre Dame Notre Dame rolls through the regular season and actually makes the college football. They lose, they start out, I think, what, 10-0, and then lose to Clemson. They play the ACC that year, lose to Clemson in the ACC championship game, and then still get to play in the college football playoff against Alabama and lose that as well. Well, SC, that was the season where SC only played six games. Was a decent team. They didn't even play Notre Dame that year, so that would have been like one of the few times where SC actually had the opportunity to probably knock off a decent Notre Dame team. And I think that's part of the part of the issue is just like Notre Dame has not been good enough in enough years to make the game like really exciting top 10 national matchup. It just hasn't happened a lot. So that's, I think, one of the. I'm not saying, look, we're not dropping the game, but it is going to be tricky where we're locked into nine game Big Ten schedules, and then we have locked into Notre Dame, and then does that mean going forward we'll never play two teams outside of the Big Ten? Maybe that's the case, but maybe the Big Ten does add a Miami or Clemson or Florida State. We'll have to see.
Well, Chase, what do you think about, like, obviously when you have these cupcakes that come play you, the home team will pay for your travel, right? They'll pay for, Alabama will pay for Alabama State to come play them in Tuscaloosa or whatnot. I mean, given how important that game is for Notre Dame to stay relevant, like, why doesn't Notre Dame just cut us a check for $10 million to come play them?
Well, I mean, yeah, that maybe that's the future. That'd be an interesting. I don't know if we'd ever approach that negotiation with them. I do wonder about that because that could actually start a legitimate fight over the game. But I mean, it's weird because Notre Dame
Join the
still,
Big Ten, right? Join the Big Ten. Options there, right? I
I mean,
mean,
Notre Dame still does, and the truth is, they still do have a big, they draw a big viewing audience. Just because of the kind of the historic nature of the program, but unlike like Duke, they have not been able to maintain like a high level of performance. And yeah, we're talking about, I think that Cotton Bowl Lou Holtz won after the 1993 season. That's it. That's the last major bowl game Notre Dame has won. 1993. That's 30 years ago. Anyway, okay. Jason, do you got anything else before we get out of here?
two things. USC's got to look in the mirror a little bit on the football side, in the last 10 years of this rivalry as well, right? Like, if you want to talk about like why it hasn't been a marquee matchup, there's enough blame to go around there. I totally agree with you. It has been interesting, right? Like, USC has definitely had the higher highs. It's also had the lower lows at certain points. So that's that on that. I did just want to return to the basketball team for just a second because we said we were going to do strengths and weaknesses, and I realized that I really didn't talk about my weaknesses. So I want to do it really fast before we get out of here, right? I went through the offense in great detail and said why I think it's going to be a really top offense. But defensively, I think this team is going to struggle a bit because of a few things, right? Rim protection, forcing turnovers, St. Thomas, Kevin Patton. Probably the exceptions here. I'm interested to see the effects of Muss's system on, in terms of just like being up all the time, pressing a lot, aggressive defense, big long lineups, right? Like, can that create systematically more turnovers than these guys otherwise have generated in their careers independently? If you just go by how these people have played as individual man defenders, like I do think it could be a struggle forcing turnovers, but I would like to see the kind of system effects there. Lack of shot blocking on the roster generally. And then back on the offensive side, right? We've talked about a million times, ball handling, not having a true pass versus this guy in the roster. So that's kind of the full picture of the team. I wanted to just say that. I know Nick alluded to it earlier that I'd done this deep dive that said that, the defense was going to be pretty poor, as poor as the offense should be good. So just wanted to get into a little bit more of why that might be the case. And we can obviously get into it more as the weeks go on, as we get toward the season here.
Yeah, and obviously there is the funny thing is Muss is actually not really known for his teams for him. He's brought in a lot of transfers. He's not necessarily known for elevating the level of offensive play of his transfers, but on the defensive end, I think you can make an argument. And certainly you've seen some of Muss's teams where they play very, very stingy defense, very aggressive pressing defense, and using players that were not necessarily known for that when they entered the program. So yeah, this is definitely something to keep an eye on. Nick, you got anything else before we get out of here?
One quick note on the defense. I agree that athletically there are serious limitations. One thing I will note, though, in general, is that more experienced teams do tend to be better defensively, just because you have these players that kind of know what it takes from an intensity standpoint to play high level college basketball. And I know just following that Marvin Bagley Duke team where they had him and Trey Duvall and Gary Trent and those guys, They were very athletic, but they were much better offensively than defensively, and you see that a lot with Cal's teams, and this Kentucky team was another good example of that, right? Rob Dillingham just could not guard, a trash can for them last year, and they were top 10 offense and I think sub 75, top 75 defense. So, yeah, again, think we will be much better offensively than defensively, but don't think the floor is like so low on D. I know we're jumping around, a lot here towards the end. One last thought on the conference realignment thing. Just wanted to bounce this off you guys is, if we get this consolidation where, maybe North Carolina, Miami, Clemson, Florida State, all leave the ACC, we have a 14 team playoff coming, right? How many spots are you going to want to allocate to non-Big Ten or SEC schools at that point? I mean, do you even need a formal college football playoff, or do you just, get together with the SEC and say, we're going to do our own championship, screw the NCAA, and we're going to put it on ESPN and Fox?
Well, I think if they do that, they're going to have to wait until the current one expires, I'm pretty sure. And which, of course, the timetable on this could be until everything does expire. I think that's definitely something that could be in the cards. You could definitely, I can imagine there will be antitrust lawsuits that would follow that. Because I know the group, I remember the group of five schools either started litigation or threatened litigation regarding the college football playoff because those schools are kind of not were being excluded from consideration, and there was a whole settlement where they got a guaranteed spot in one of the rotational bowls. I'm not sure, Jason, do you, is it now the case that like they have a guaranteed spot in the 12 man and will be the 14 man playoff for a group of five
Yeah,
school?
I believe they get one. They get one
And then there's a
collectively.
special. There's a special qualification too for Notre Dame. I can't remember what that is, but I think it's, like Notre Dame just has to be like a top 16 team or something, I think, and they get
Yeah,
in.
I think it basically has to be like just they have to, right? It's 12 teams, but you're gonna not have teams 1 through 12 because you might have a champion of like a lesser league that's ranked 17th or something like that. And so Notre Dame just has to basically be inside of the top whatever 10, 12, whatever that threshold is in the final rankings. And like if they're above that number, then they're automatically in, basically.
Yeah, and then are they doing conference champions? Are they for the Power Four? I can't remember. That's
I think it is.
Yeah, and they're not only getting auto bids, but they're getting auto like top four seeds, I believe. So that's why you're seeing a lot of projections right now with Utah as the number three seed because they get an auto top four seed if they win the Big 12. That's the yeah,
the top four conference champions get the 1 through 4 and get a bye in the 12 team, which is just insane. I mean, it's crazy, but.
Well, yeah,
I mean, that's like a good, it's not a great spot financially necessarily for the ACC and the Big 12, but like in terms of your spot in this bracket, that's a pretty good place to get put into the bracket because, where is the ACC or Big 12 champion otherwise going to be in a 12 team playoff? They may or may not make it, right? Like now they're going to be the 3 or 4 seed.
Yeah, and then obviously the bye is going to change once the expansion to 14 teams, right? Because only two teams will get byes. Yeah, so.
It just feels like the entire selection and seeding process right now is slanted away from the Big Ten and the SEC, which is kind of crazy to think about given the relative power that those conferences should have in theory here. So I think some things are going to have to change. And again, like it's very beneficial for Notre Dame. It almost feels like they're going to have an auto bid to the playoff without joining a conference in the coming years here, which is kind of nuts.
Yeah, and I think the contract goes to 2031. So after that there'd be the changes. By the way, I'm assuming that after that contract, the economic see, so ESPN already gave away some of these games. They licensed them out to TNT. I don't know if you guys saw that. So I'm wondering after 2031, it'd be the economics here are just going to be, I just think, radically different. Especially considering like the amount of money that the NBA has been able to charge for, I guess, an 11-year extension of their media rights, and obviously like college football, draws much higher ratings than the NBA games do. So I'll be very curious. Now, look, it's 2031, so that's a ways away, but yeah, it's I think there will be changes, and it may just be the. By then, it may just be the Big Ten, the SEC, and maybe they'll open a couple. I mean, I don't know if we need a 14-team playoff between the SEC and Big Ten, but I could see there being something like that, and maybe they'll open a couple spots to other schools. I don't know. That'd be interesting.
I think you're just gonna you're just gonna see, how these at-large berths get allocated. And I think the Big Ten and the SEC, look, it may be slanted away from them slightly in terms of qualification based on the leverage they have, but financially, it's very much slanted toward them. And I think with these at-large berths, you're gonna see a great number of teams from these two leagues fill out those brackets. And I think if you don't, is where you're gonna see trouble ahead, right? Because it's obvious that this is moving toward consolidation of power into the future. We haven't even talked about the house settlement and how much money these schools are going to be paying out to their players moving forward. Like, this is very much turning into the haves and the have-nots, and the haves are going to start consolidating their power pretty soon, I think.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And look, the Big Ten media rights deal is not that long. I think that's only a 7-year deal. So once that comes up, those are going to be very, very, very valuable. I mean, we're seeing the complete collapse of all linear programming outside of sports right now. A perfect example is like the first round of the NBA Finals. It drew less than 11 million people, just like right at 11 million, which is actually down for me in the last couple of years, but for linear television, it had something like a 20% share and a 48% share for people under the age of 34. So it's like for people actually turning on conventional televisions and not watching streaming services, like sports is absolutely dominant now. And I think that's not going to change. And it's going to. To the extent like linear television even exists in 7 years, it's like sports is going to be completely dominated, right? Because with the forcing people to watch it live, there's really no other programming you can force people to watch live.
Yeah, then you get into the whole conversation of I don't know if you guys have demoed the Apple Vision Pro at all yet, but for live sports in the coming years, I don't know if it's going to be the full-on headset or a pair of glasses or how the tech evolves, but they can basically, on that headset, put you in the dugout of an MLB game or, on the sidelines of a football game. So, just the whole viewing experience is going to be, I think, radically different over the next decade here.
Yep, agreed. Okay, anything else, guys, before we get out?
That's all I got,
No,
Chase.
I'm good.
All right. Well, we'll do, like I said, we're gonna do hopefully here soon a Big Ten preview. I think we'll try to do that on the Big Ten podcast platform, but we'll probably put it out on the USC Hoops platform as well. So until then, everyone, fight on.
Fight on.
Fight on.